Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 4th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, State at Highest Level of Transfer by Meg Wingerder. Assistance in Colorado. FEMA gives $8 million to help pay for COVID funerals by Taylor Shaw. Colorado Judicial Department, Dual Investigations into Court System, Move Ahead by Shelley Bradbury. Negus Reddy's Gun Bill by John Aguilar, The Denver Post, and following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, State at Highest Level of Transfer. Tier 3 of the Colorado Hospital Association's plan was not reached during worst point of 2020. By Meg Wingerder, The Denver Post. With beds filling, the Colorado Hospital Association announced Wednesday that it was moving to the highest level of its plan to ease transfers between hospitals, a point not reached even during the worst of the deadly COVID-19 surge in fall and winter 2020. The state's hospitals had been operating under the first tier of their transfer plan since August, when COVID-19 cases began increasing in Colorado as the more transmissible Delta variant of the virus took over. Tier 1 was similar to a buddy system, in which smaller hospitals were paired with hospital networks with more resources to coordinate transfers, said Kara Welch, spokeswoman for the Colorado Hospital Association. On Wednesday, with statewide COVID-19 hospitalizations at their highest point of 2021, the Hospital Association skipped over Tier 2, which would have involved coordinating transfers on a regional level, and went straight to Tier 3, a level at which hospital leaders across Colorado will be working together, she said. The need is going to be statewide, she said. It's really about maximizing what's there. The transfer plan, which was activated in November 2020, never got past Tier 1 last year. The people in charge of transfers for the hospital systems will meet virtually twice a day to figure out where beds are available and which patients can move into them safely, Welch said. For example, if a metro area hospital needs to free up beds for sicker patients, it could arrange a transfer to a rural facility where those who are on the mend can finish their recovery, she said. Some of those two-way transfers happened last year, with sicker patients moving to cities and recovering ones heading to smaller hospitals. A statewide order issued Sunday laid the groundwork for moving to Tier 3 by requiring all hospitals to accept transfers and giving facilities permission to send patients to any hospital that can care for their needs, even if it's not one the patient would prefer, Welch said. The plan is to try to keep patients as close to home as possible, both for their convenience and to avoid unnecessarily long trips that tie up ambulances. But some patients may end up being cared for farther from home, she said. We need to be able to move patients where there are resources, she said. Some of Colorado's COVID-19 numbers continued to trend the wrong way in the middle of the week. Hospitalizations rose again Wednesday, with 1,280 people, the highest number since December of 2020, receiving care across the state for confirmed cases of COVID-19. Outbreaks also kept rising and were at their highest level since Colorado changed its criteria and stopped counting clusters involving fewer than 5 cases in most settings. Long-term care facilities still have to declare an outbreak after 2 related cases. As of Wednesday, the state had 607 active outbreaks. Schools accounted for the largest share of those outbreaks, with 242, followed by nursing homes and assisted living facilities with 79 and 77, respectively. The percentage of tests coming back positive dipped slightly, however, as did the average number of cases reported each day over the last week. New cases, however, were still at levels comparable to late December. From October 26 to November 2, one in every 281 people in Colorado was diagnosed with COVID-19, making it the ninth highest rate among states of new cases per 100,000 residents, according to Associated Press data. The state's seven-day rolling average of daily new cases has risen over the past 2 weeks from nearly 2,254 new cases per day in late October to 2,899 new cases per day as of Monday. Welch appealed to Coloradans to protect hospital capacity by getting vaccinated against COVID-19, wearing masks in public, avoiding crowds, and washing their hands frequently. Although the majority of current hospitalizations aren't caused by the virus, those that are can most likely be prevented in the short term, she said. Unlike heart attacks and strokes, where a person's risk builds up over years or decades, we really do need help from the public, she said. The Associated Press contributed to this report. Assistance in Colorado. FEMA gives $8 million to help pay for COVID funerals, by Taylor Shaw, the Denver Post. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's COVID-19 Funeral Assistance Program has provided more than $8 million to Coloradans to help pay for funeral expenses of people whose deaths are related to COVID-19. And applications for funds are still being accepted, the agency said in a news release. Funerals can be financially straining, with an average cost of $7,000, according to U.S. Funerals Online. Given the increased financial stress of the pandemic, which has caused more than 8,500 reported deaths in Colorado, Congress authorized FEMA to help residents pay for funerals. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought overwhelming grief to many families, FEMA stated on its website. At FEMA, our mission is to help people before, during, and after disasters. We are dedicated to helping ease some of the financial stress and burden caused by the virus. FEMA's program offers financial assistance for funeral expenses incurred after January 20, 2020, for deaths related to COVID-19, FEMA stated in the news release. This includes funds to help pay for cremation, burial expenses, transfer of remains, headstones, transportation for identifying the deceased individual, and more. As of Tuesday, 1,487 Coloradans have received funds amounting to more than $8.3 million from the program, FEMA said in a release. With no end set on the program, applications are still being accepted. Applicants can apply for funds to help pay for multiple funerals, with up to $9,000 available per funeral and a maximum of $35,000 per application, FEMA said. Applicants must be U.S. citizens, non-citizen nationals, or qualified legal immigrants, but the deceased person does not need to meet those requirements. Those interested in applying can call FEMA at 844-684-6333 between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. The text teletype number, TTY, for those who are deaf or hard of hearing is 800-462-7585. Colorado Judicial Department. Dual investigations into court system move ahead, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. The Colorado Judicial Department has cleared the way for a pair of independent investigations to go forward into allegations of judicial misconduct and a cover-up at the highest levels of the state's court system, nearly 10 months after the Denver Post first reported the scandal. State officials finalized contracts for investigations by a pair of Denver law firms on October 12th and Monday. Investigations into both matters will begin immediately, Chief Justice Brian Boatwright said in a statement Wednesday. We expect the process to last several months and will provide timely updates as often as possible. One firm, Investigations Law Group, will examine claims of widespread workplace harassment and sexism in the judiciary. Separately, RCT Limited, led by former U.S. Attorney Bob Troyer, will investigate an allegation that top judicial officials tried to use a $2.5 million contract to keep one former employee from speaking out about some of that misconduct. That employee, now former Judicial Department Chief of Staff Mindy Macias, was facing termination for financial irregularities when she threatened to reveal the misconduct by judges and officials in a lawsuit, former state court administrator Christopher Ryan alleged this year. At the time, high-ranking judicial officials, including now-retired state Supreme Court Chief Justice Nathan Ben Coates, agreed to give Macias a $2.5 million five-year training contract to buy her silence, Ryan claimed. Judicial officials initially denied any wrongdoing, but then vowed to fully investigate. Macias was prepared to make public allegations of sexual misconduct, including that one judge sent a pornographic email on his work account and that another rubbed his hairy chest on a female employee's back, according to a memo penned in 2018. This spring, several women who worked in the court system told the Post that Macias' allegations were indicative of a broader toxic culture for women within the judiciary. With the investigations ready to proceed, this serves as a reminder that the entire judicial branch is expected to cooperate with the requests and inquiries made by the investigators, Boatwright said in a news release. As previously promised, the results of the investigations and recommendations of the investigators will be taken seriously and made public. The contracts were announced in August as going to RCT Limited and Investigations Law Group, but were not finalized immediately. The contract with Investigations Law Group was signed Monday. The firm will be paid no more than $250,000 for the work, according to the contract, obtained by the Post through an open records request. A contract with RCT Limited for no more than $75,000 was signed October 12th. Both contracts specify that the Judicial Department will not supervise or control the independent investigations. Perhaps the most important question is the unstated one: whether the public can trust that the Judicial Department is taking this problem seriously and not just checking the box or going through the motions to address reported issues in the judicial workplace, leaders of Investigations Law Group wrote in their proposal for the contract. Investigations Law Group is headed by attorney Liz Rita and has handled past inquiries into sexual harassment complaints within the Colorado General Assembly, as well as the investigation into allegations against Denver School Board member Tay Anderson this year. Troyer's firm previously investigated allegations of sexual misconduct by Catholic priests in Colorado. Former Denver Independent Monitor Nick Mitchell will help lead the investigation into the judicial contract. Our diverse team has decades of experience conducting and reporting publicly on complex and sensitive investigations at the federal, state, and local levels, objectively, fairly, and thoroughly, Troyer wrote in his firm's proposal. Troyer expects his investigation to take about 3 months, while the effort by Investigations Law Group is expected to stretch for 6 months, the proposals show. 8 bids were submitted to the Judicial Department to carry out the investigations, according to records provided to the Post. Other law firms interested in taking on the investigations were Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, with former Boulder County District Attorney Stan Garnett and former Colorado U.S. Attorney Jason Dunn to lead the work, Butler Snow, Hall and Evans, Hush Blackwell, Miller and Stewart, and Wilmer Hale, with the investigation to be led by former Colorado U.S. Attorney John Walsh. The law firm's investigations are 2 of at least 6 investigations launched this year into the circumstances around the contract. The FBI, Office of the State Auditor, Attorney Regulation Counsel, and the Colorado Commission on Judicial Discipline also have investigations underway. Election 2021. Murphy wins in New Jersey, Youngkin claims Virginia. By Will Wiesert and Sarah Rankin, The Associated Press, byline Richmond, Virginia. Democratic Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey narrowly won re-election in his reliably blue state, while a Republican political newcomer delivered a stunning upset in the Virginia governor's race, sending a warning Wednesday to Democrats that their grip on power in Washington may be in peril. In Virginia, Glenn Youngkin became the first Republican to win statewide office in a dozen years, tapping into culture war fights over schools and race to unite former President Donald Trump's most fervent supporters with enough suburban voters to notch a victory. Meanwhile, Murphy eked out a victory against GOP challenger Jack Ciattarelli, who mounted a surprisingly strong campaign on issues including taxes and opposition to pandemic mask and vaccination mandates. The two states' results were particularly alarming to Democrats because of where they happened. President Joe Biden carried Virginia by 10 points last year. He took New Jersey by more than 15. Given the scale of those victories, neither state was seen as especially competitive when this year's campaigns began. But the first major elections of Biden's presidency suggested growing discontent among voters. They also underscored that with Trump out of office, Democrats can't center their messages on opposition to him. The results ultimately pointed to a potentially painful year ahead for Democrats as they try to maintain thin majorities in Congress. And they put a new focus on congressional Democrats' inability so far to pass Biden's massive domestic policy legislation, although it's unclear whether the defeat will be enough to jolt his party into action. Speaking from the White House on Wednesday afternoon, Biden said Democrats need to produce for the American people. Republicans celebrated their strong showing, with Youngkin telling a cheering crowd of supporters that this is the spirit of Virginia coming together like never before. The GOP's strength extended to down-ballot contests, including the lieutenant governor's race, which Winsome Sears won, becoming the first woman of color to win Virginia's statewide office. McAuliffe formally conceded in a statement Wednesday morning and congratulated Youngkin. "Losing is never easy," he said. "We put ourselves out there and left it all on the field." A political neophyte, Youngkin was able to take advantage of apparent apathy among core Democratic voters, fatigued by years of elections that were seen as must-wins, as well as growing frustrations with Biden and the economy. He successfully portrayed McAuliffe, a former Virginia governor, Democratic National Committee chairman, and close friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton, as part of an elite class of politicians. He also seized on a late-stage stumble by McAuliffe, who during a debate suggested parents should have a minimal role in shaping school curriculums. Perhaps most significantly, Youngkin prevailed in a task that has stumped scores of Republicans before him, attracting Trump's base while also appealing to suburban voters who were repelled by the former president's divisive behavior. During the campaign, Youngkin stated his support for election integrity, a nod at Trump's lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, while also focusing on education and business-friendly policies. He never campaigned in person with Trump, successfully challenging McAuliffe's effort to cast him as a clone of the former president. That approach could provide a model for Republicans competing in future races that feature significant numbers of Democratic or independent voters. Elsewhere Tuesday, some of the nation's largest cities held mayoral contests. Democratic former police captain Eric Adams won in New York, and Boston voters elected city councilor Michelle Wu as the city's first female and Asian American mayor. Cincinnati is getting its first Asian American mayor, Aftab Pirival. Minneapolis voters rejected a ballot initiative that sought to overhaul policing in their city, where George Floyd was killed by a white police officer on Memorial Day 2020. sparking the largest wave of protests against racial injustice in generations. The initiative would have replaced the police force with a Department of Public Safety charged with undertaking a comprehensive public health approach to policing. But no other contest in this off-year election season received the level of national attention and money as the governor's race in Virginia, a state with broad swaths of college-educated suburban voters who are increasingly influential in swaying control of Congress and the White House. A former co-CEO at the Carlyle Group with a lanky 6'6" build that once made him a reserve forward on Rice University's basketball team, Youngkin poured vast amounts of his personal fortune into a campaign that spent more than $59 million. Favoring fleece vests, Youngkin sought to cut the image of a genial suburban dad. Youngkin ran confidently on a conservative platform. He opposed a major clean energy mandate that the state passed 2 years ago and objected to abortion in most circumstances. He also opposed mask and vaccine mandates, and he promised to expand Virginia's limited charter schools and ban critical race theory, an academic framework that centers on the idea that racism is systemic in the nation's institutions and that they function to maintain the dominance of white people. In recent months, it has become a catch-all political buzzword for any teaching in schools about race and American history. McAuliffe tried to energize the Democratic base by highlighting abortion, denouncing a new Texas law that largely banned the procedure, and warning that Youngkin would seek to implement similar restrictions. Youngkin didn't discuss abortion much publicly, and a liberal activist caught him on tape saying the issue couldn't help him during the campaign. He said an election win would allow the party to start going on offense on the issue. While McAuliffe pulled on the star power of a host of national Democrats, including former President Barack Obama and ex-Georgia governor candidate Stacey Abrams, Youngkin largely campaigned on his own, focusing on issues he said were important to Virginians. Polls showed the race tightening after McAuliffe said during a late September debate that he didn't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. That prompted Youngkin to run hundreds of TV ads on the statement and to focus on his own pledges to make school curricula less un-American and to overhaul policies on transgender students in school bathrooms. The race took an especially bitter turn last week when Youngkin ran an ad featuring a mother and GOP activist who 8 years ago led an effort to ban Beloved, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Black Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, from classrooms. McAuliffe accused Youngkin of uncorking a racist dog whistle, but Youngkin said Virginia parents knew what was really at stake, and so did families across the country. That was a nod to how tapping into parental activism could work for the GOP next year and in future election cycles. America is watching Virginia, Youngkin said. Negus Reddy's Gun Bill by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. U.S. Representative Joe Negus will introduce legislation in the House today to prohibit people convicted of violent misdemeanors from purchasing a firearm for 5 years, a measure the Lafayette Democrat said could help prevent tragedies such as the Boulder King Soopers massacre from happening again. It seems pretty clear to me that in this case, that this individual would not have been able to purchase a weapon had this law been the law of the land either in Colorado and ultimately at the federal level, Negus told the Denver Post in an interview Wednesday, speaking about the Boulder suspect. That suspect in the March 22nd King Soopers shooting that left 10 people dead was convicted of misdemeanor assault in 2018 after attacking a classmate at Arvada West High School the previous year. Ahmed Al-Alawi Alyssa, then 18, punched the classmate in the head without warning, and when the boy fell to the ground, continued to punch him, according to an affidavit in the case. Alyssa was sentenced to probation and 48 hours of community service. But that didn't stop him from purchasing a gun at an Arvada gun shop days before his deadly assault at the Boulder grocery store, Negus said. We learned he had a well-documented history of violence, that he was convicted of third-degree assault, which is a violent misdemeanor, and that despite that conviction, he ultimately was legally eligible under state and federal law, it appears, to purchase a weapon, the congressman said, which is untenable, in my view, and one that we can easily fix. But the prospect of Neguse's bill, dubbed the End Gun Violence Act, getting through the Senate, which is evenly split between both political parties and where the little gun control legislation has passed in recent decades, is uncertain at best. The congressman acknowledged as much, but said, "We should never assume that the Senate is impervious to public opinion." Colorado lawmakers passed a bill this past spring that prohibits those convicted of certain misdemeanor crimes from buying a gun for 5 years. But Neguse's office said, with fewer than half the states having that kind of legislation, these individuals are still eligible to purchase firearms in the remaining states, creating a patchwork of eligibility and increasing the risk of firearm-related violence. To address this epidemic of gun violence, we have to propose a national solution to be implemented across the country, Neguse said. But Dave Koppel, research director at the Libertarian-leaning Independence Institute and an advocate of Second Amendment rights, said what matters is which specific crimes are cited to stop someone from buying a gun. The Neguse bill is presumably going to be dependent on state law definitions of crimes, and state definitions vary widely, Koppel said. Some are tightly written, and some are so broad that the Neguse bill could prohibit the exercise of constitutional rights by people for very minor misconduct. Koppel said the bill could face the same pitfalls a 1980s federal law that sought to impose tougher sentences on those previously convicted of a felony involving conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, faced in 2015. When the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the law as unconstitutionally vague. The vagueness problem is much easier to avoid at the state level, where the legislature can list the specific laws of the particular that trigger the prohibition, Koppel said. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Doherty, the chief prosecutor in the King Soopers case, said Neguse's bill is sound in that it focuses on people who have recently proven to be of real danger to others in the community. I think it's ridiculous that someone who has been convicted of violent assault has the unfettered right to access firearms, Doherty said. We need real action to reduce the ability of dangerous people to get firearms. The mother of a slain King Soopers employee, Terry Leaker, said Wednesday that a federal law to help keep guns and ammunition out of the hands of people who have been convicted of violent misdemeanor crimes is essential. State laws prohibiting gun sales to these type of individual do not protect innocent people in other states who don't have strict gun laws, Margie Woodington said. Federal legislation is absolutely necessary. Neguse's office cites a 2001 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that concludes, male handgun purchasers with one prior conviction for a violent misdemeanor compared with those with no prior criminal history are more than 8 times as likely to be charged later with gun and/or violent crimes. Inaction is not an option, Neguse said. People are tired of Congress abdicating its role to protect our community and keep us safe. Lawsuit filed against state. Group sues over ban on Native American school mascots by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. A North Dakota-based organization this week sued Colorado for banning American Indian school mascots, arguing the state shouldn't outlaw culturally sensitive uses of Native American names and imagery. The lawsuit, filed Tuesday in U.S. District Court by the nonprofit Native American Guardians Association, named several Colorado officials, including Governor Jared Polis, Attorney General Phil Weiser, and Catherine Redhorse, the executive director of the Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs. The lawsuit alleges SB 21-116, which was signed into law in June, is discriminatory and unconstitutional. Other plaintiffs include a John Doe and Jane Doe, and 3 others who cite Native heritage in the lawsuit. Demetrius Marez, a Lamar High School alumnus, Chase Aubrey Robidoux, a Yuma High School alumnus, and Donald Wayne Smith Jr., a pastor at Yuma Christian Church and former teacher. Plaintiffs oppose the use of American Indian mascot performers and caricatures that mock Native American heritage, such as Lamar High School's former mascot, Chief Ugly, or the Atlanta Braves' former Native American caricature, Chief Nakahoma, in sports and other public venues, the lawsuit states. Nevertheless, culturally appropriate Native American names, logos, and imagery serve to honor Native Americans and to help public schools neutralize offensive and stereotypical Native American caricatures and iconography while teaching students and the general public about American Indian history. Polis's office declined to comment Wednesday. Backers of SB21-116 have said the mascots and names are denigrating and humiliating, and research has shown that this type of imagery negatively affects all students, not just American Indians. The American Psychological Association called for these types of mascots to be retired in 2005. In a written statement, NAGA board member Eunice Davidson Wichanpawastewin, Good Star Woman, said that SB21-116 discriminates against the plaintiffs by conferring benefits on non-Native American bystanders who are not the targets of racism and discrimination with regard to Native American names, logos, and imagery. One of NAGA's primary goals is to partner with school districts to reappropriate Native American names as honorifics in order to reclaim their meaning and to teach non-Native American students about Native American history. The issue is not new to Colorado. In 2015, then-Governor John Hickenlooper formed the Commission to Study American Indian Representations in Public Schools, and it recommended Native American mascots be removed unless the schools came to agreements with federally recognized tribes. The commission cited misrepresentation and stereotypes perpetrated by the imagery. However, only a handful of schools made changes to their mascots or sought agreements with tribes between the time of the recommendations and the bill's passage. Previous attempts to pass bills such as SB21-116 were unsuccessful until this year. As of July, about 25 schools in Colorado had Native American mascots that had to be changed by June 1, 2022, or they could face monthly fines of $25,000. An exception was made for schools that had existing agreements with tribes. Strasburg and Arapaho high schools have such agreements. Some schools started working on new mascots as the bill made its way through the legislature, but others, such as the Lamar Savages, which uses Native American imagery, had not. The school board decided to hold off until January to make any changes, awaiting a potential lawsuit outcome, according to the Lamar Ledger. Darius Smith, who is Navajo and served on the governor's commission, has been working on the issue of removing American Indian mascots in Colorado for more than 30 years. He said that although NAGA purports to speak for the silenced majority of Native Americans, it does not have credibility or represent the way many American Indians feel about the issue. A lot of the studies and the research was also being twisted, Smith said. Initially, the NFL team in Washington was trying to gain support from organizations and so-called tribes so they could keep their mascot, which they only got rid of recently. And Smith said, that is the same approach this group is taking. But there's really good reputable research and study at universities by organizations that tell the truth rather than the fly-by-night organizations, he said. NAGA is challenging SB21-116's constitutionality because it bans all American Indian names and imagery and lumps them under the term mascot, the lawsuit states, but does not do this for other groups, said attorney William Trockman of Lakewood-based Mountain States Legal Foundation. Southwest employee suspected human trafficking. Mixed-race family stopped at DIA, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. A woman and her 10-year-old daughter were stopped by police at Denver International Airport last month after a flight attendant flagged the duo as suspicious, an assumption the woman said is racist. Mary McCarthy, who is white, and her 10-year-old daughter, who was black, flew from San Jose, California to Denver on October 22nd to be with family after the sudden death of McCarthy's older brother the night before. When they arrived in Denver, they were met on the jet bridge by a Southwest Airlines employee and two Denver police officers. At first, McCarthy thought the police were there to tell her about another death in her family. The two officers started talking to McCarthy and her daughter, Moira, separately. The officers wanted to question McCarthy and her daughter because a Southwest Airlines employee had reported them as suspicious and McCarthy as a potential human trafficker, according to a Denver police report and McCarthy's account. The officer said, "We're talking to you because you were reported to the pilot for suspicious behavior," McCarthy said. "And it immediately occurred to me what was going on. This is the type of situation that mixed-race families and families of color face all the time while traveling." McCarthy explained why they were traveling and that the girl who sobbed through the incident was indeed her daughter. The officers and employee let her go after McCarthy explained why she was traveling. McCarthy said she is not angry at how the officers and Southwest employee treated her on the jet bridge. She is angry, however, at the Southwest employee on the plane who reported her without any conversation or contact. The flight attendant who reported McCarthy told police she was suspicious because the two were the last to board the plane and because McCarthy asked other passengers to move so her daughter could sit next to her, according to a copy of a police report obtained by the Denver Post through a records request. The attendant also reported that the pair did not speak during the flight. McCarthy said they boarded the plane last because they were assigned the last boarding group and that the passengers on the plane did not have a problem rearranging their seating. McCarthy said she and her daughter did not speak much during the flight because she was trying to catch up on lost sleep and her daughter was listening to an audiobook. "The whole thing is based on what I believe to be a racist assumption about a mixed-race family," McCarthy said. "Mixed-race families have made multiple public complaints about being questioned as human trafficking suspects while flying in the United States. A white Phoenix man flying home from vacation with his family, including his adopted Chinese daughter, was stopped by police after a Southwest flight attendant reported him as suspicious. A black woman from Aurora flying with her adopted white sister was stopped by police in Dallas after a passenger on a Frontier Airlines flight reported her to airline workers as a potential trafficker. Cindy McCain, widow of Senator John McCain, in 2019 apologized after incorrectly claiming she stopped a human trafficking crime when she reported a woman traveling with a toddler of a different ethnicity at the Phoenix airport, saying the pair looked odd and that "something didn't click with me." Police in Phoenix later confirmed McCain reported a woman but said they investigated and there was no evidence of a crime. McCarthy wants an apology from Southwest for its employees' racist assumption about her and her daughter. The police report on the incident also angered McCarthy because the officers wrote McCarthy did not want to give any information. But McCarthy gave an explanation of why she was traveling and gave the officers her identification, she said. A video she recorded, a part of the interaction, shows her explaining her travel. Southwest media team declined to answer specific questions about the incident, including who reported McCarthy and her daughter, the basis of that person's suspicions, and what signs Southwest employees are trained to look for as evidence of trafficking. Southwest regrets that this family reports anything less than a positive experience while traveling with us, the company said in an emailed statement. The customer's report has been shared with Southwest's customer relations team, and they will be following up with the customer directly. Southwest Airlines in 2019 announced it would provide online training to all of its employees on how to identify human trafficking and what steps to take if trafficking is suspected. Public-facing employees, such as pilots and flight attendants, attend additional training. The entire incident at the airport made a difficult day even harder for Moira, McCarthy said. She just kind of clams up when we talk about it, McCarthy said. COP26 in Scotland, students join UN Climate Summit. Some have been putting pressure on our administrators to have the campus do the right things. By Bruce Finley, The Denver Post. Colorado State University student Katie Barker rides buses or her bicycle for transport, buys only used clothing, and eats vegetarian local food, aligning her actions with efforts to contain climate warming. She's among the students and researchers from Colorado universities who went to Glasgow, Scotland, for the COP26 Climate Summit this week. At home, they're pushing campus administrators to create climate-friendly lifestyles. And at this 12-day summit, Barker and others are sharing ideas with thousands of young participants from around the world for achieving the 2015 Paris Agreement targets that would limit warming to 2.7 to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. The COP26 summit is definitely the breeding ground for ideas and hopefully optimism, said Barker, 30, who grew up in Steamboat Springs and is studying ecosystem science with a focus on soil. A growing climate action army led by young people appears unstoppable, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday at the summit, where he warned of approaching tipping points leading to uncontrollable heating. Students from Colorado have been putting pressure on our administrators to have the campus do the right things, said CSU Ecosystem Sciences Professor Jillian Bowser, who is leading a group of six students in Glasgow. It is a group that wants to roll up sleeves and dive in. Their time for complaining is over. Their time for being depressed is over. They want to do something. CSU students persuaded school officials to install more bike lanes on the Fort Collins campus, offer more meatless meals, improve waste recycling, and launch an electric shuttle bus, Bowser said. Students also have requested more climate-related courses. The eco-grief paralyzing students in recent years has given way to a sharper focus on practical action for limiting warming, CU Environmental Studies Director Max Boykoff said. We have moved through, collectively, disillusionment, he said. Now we're thinking, let's get on with this. How can we adapt? How can we reduce our emissions? Boykoff planned to monitor the summit from Boulder, but a dozen University of Colorado students, staffers, and researchers from labs surrounding the Boulder campus attended. If the system's going to change, we have to vote with our wallets, CU staffer Gina Fiorello, 25, a program coordinator for the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Science, said in an email from Glasgow. Student participants discussed environmental impacts of beef production and suggested campaigns to eat more plants and less meat so demand drops, she said. CU students since the 1970s have been demanding robust recycling. A few years ago, students occupied the CU chancellor's office demanding divestment of CU foundation funds from fossil fuel companies. This year, a school survey of students found 94% came to the campus partly because of opportunities to address climate warming, CU Chief Sustainability Officer Heidi Van Genderen said. Students increasingly use e-bikes and e-scooters as alternatives to driving, Van Genderen said. They recently persuaded officials to buy 4 electric shuttle buses and helped write a new campus energy plan requiring increased conservation. At Fort Lewis College in Durango, students have shifted from street protests to attending city council meetings where they press leaders to take climate action, said Kathleen Hillemier, a professor in the school's Environment and Sustainability Department. Students recently launched an e-bike library where they can check out e-bikes for a semester, and they collect food waste from dining halls for compost in campus gardens. Being at the summit gives a glimpse of how change can happen, said CSU graduate student Jacob Janus, 22, who has been studying international climate agreements and holds an undergraduate degree in atmospheric science. It can be really hard to be optimistic. There are days when we look at the scientific reports and we're like, how are we going to fix this? Janus said. But a lot of us are channeling that into action. It's the best way for us to deal with our concerns about climate change. In news briefs, driver accused of killing two is charged with murder. A driver who allegedly killed two people while fleeing police in Brighton has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder, among other charges. Nicholas Viarini, 27, also was charged with first-degree assault and vehicular eluding, both felonies, according to the Adams County District Attorney's Office. Viarini allegedly was driving a stolen car October 26th, with police in pursuit when he ran a stop sign, hitting another car and killing a passenger, before hitting a pedestrian who also died at a hospital, police said. Gustavo Mesqueda Ortega, 25, of Montrose, and Dulce Castro Perez, 21, of Hudson, were killed, the coroner's office told the Denver Channel. The incident unfolded about 11:20 a.m. when officers went to the area of Gaviota Avenue and Goldfinch Street on a report of a suspicious vehicle, a police news release said. Officers said that the vehicle was being stolen and the suspect driver rammed an officer's vehicle. The pursuit lasted about 2 minutes, police said. A 25-year-old woman in the stolen car also was treated at a hospital for injuries. Man faces arson charge. He is accused of setting Longmont area house on fire while trying to clear cobwebs with blowtorch. John Charles Streckenbach has been arrested on suspicion of first-degree arson, criminal mischief causing $20,000 to $100,000 damage, possession of a controlled substance, and violation of a protection order. No serious injuries were reported in the fire, which occurred about 4:25 p.m. Monday in the 8800 block of Vermilion Road, north of Longmont in Boulder County. According to an affidavit, Streckenbach admitted to using a blowtorch to get rid of the cobwebs in the crawl space under the home. He said he attempted to put out the fire for an hour by himself before calling emergency crews. The fire caused an estimated $100,000 damage to the home. Deputies found a charred section of the crawl space that was free of cobwebs with a blowtorch on the ground. According to the affidavit, police said they also found a small bag of methamphetamine on Streckenbach. Streckenbach has prior convictions for false reporting, possession of a controlled substance, marijuana distribution, gaming fraud, and theft, according to online court records. These are from staff and wire reports. Free noodles and coffee for inmates who vaccinate. As a safety measure to slow the spread of the COVID-19 virus, the Denver Sheriff Department is offering an incentive, complimentary ramen noodles and coffee to inmates who get vaccinated while in custody. In jails across America, vaccine incentive programs for individuals in custody are working, and we decided to move forward with implementing one as well, Sheriff Elias Diggins said. We will evaluate the program monthly and hope that it will make a difference as we all continue to combat COVID. The Sheriff Department implemented a vaccine incentive for individuals who are in custody as a way to encourage inmates to get the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In New York, prison inmates are offered pizza and McDonald's items as incentives, according to the Associated Press. The Denver Incentive Program offers 10 ramen noodle soups, or a combination of one coffee and five ramen noodle soups for each COVID-19 vaccine an individual receives, the release said. Inmates who already received the vaccine while in custody will be offered the items as well. Noodles and coffee are among commissary items offered to Denver jail inmates. They can be purchased and are in addition to the three daily meals prepared in kitchens at the downtown and county jails. This is from Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. Denver shelter overflowing with small animals. The Denver Animal Shelter said it has a critter congestion issue as it cares for a surge of rabbits, guinea pigs, mice, and turtles. 64 small animals call the shelter home right now, compared with 23 at this time in 2019. The surge has forced the shelter to use parts of its facility customarily reserved for other animals. This is where the community comes in, said Denver Animal Protection Director Ellis Nightingale. Before you buy a small animal from a pet store, please check with an animal shelter first because there's a lot of need there. The cost of small animals at the Denver shelter starts at $15. This was from Jake Shapiro, the Denver Post. Grand Junction. Patient sues, says doc used own sperm to inseminate, by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. A former Grand Junction fertility doctor is being sued once again for allegedly using his own sperm to inseminate a patient seeking an anonymous donor. In the lawsuit, filed Friday in Mesa County District Court, Betty and Carl Stevens, along with their daughter Nicole Long, said a DNA test this year revealed that Long had at least 17 other half-siblings, all connected by Dr. Paul B. Jones. At least six families already have sued Jones for the same thing, alleging he promised donor sperm to women who could not get pregnant, but instead used his own. Families realize this only after taking DNA tests such as 23andMe or Ancestry.com and found Jones to be the common denominator. Betty and Carl Stevens said in the complaint that they sought out Jones in 1981 for fertility treatment. Jones, the couple allege, told them that the donor sperm would be produced by an anonymous donor and that the individual would be young, healthy, and either a Mesa College student or a member of the business community, the complaint says. It wasn't until Long took the DNA test this year that the family found out Jones had used his own sperm instead, the lawsuit alleged. Jones, reached by phone Tuesday, declined to comment. The family also claimed that Jones carried cystic fibrosis and that several of the half-siblings connected to Jones also have the genetic disease, which can cause permanent lung infections and limit an individual's ability to breathe. The lawsuit also named Women's Healthcare of Western Colorado and Dr. Stephen Meacham, who the family allege knowingly used Dr. Jones's semen to inseminate his patients as well. Meacham and the representatives with the health clinic also declined to comment. Jones surrendered his medical license in 2019, soon after the first lawsuits were filed against his alleged practices. The case also prompted Colorado lawmakers to take action, making it a felony crime for doctors to inseminate patients with their own sperm without a patient's permission. Washington, paid leave, immigration, tax changes added to bill. Democrats rushing to smooth differences after grim election night, by Lisa Mascaro, Mary Claire Jelinek, and Farnoosh Amiri, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. House Democrats added paid family and medical leave, immigration law changes, and a state and local tax break to their $1.75 million social services and environmental bill Wednesday, reviving some key elements of President Joe Biden's agenda as they rush to finish the package after dismal overnight election results. The House Rules Committee convened Wednesday afternoon to consider the updated text of the now sprawling 2,135-page package, a crucial step ahead of the initial House votes that are possible as soon as today. The flurry of last-minute additions, on top of a plan to include lower Medicare prescription drug prices, comes as Democrats are desperate to deliver on Biden's signature domestic proposals after grim election results overnight in Virginia, where voters chose a Republican political newcomer, Glenn Youngkin, over seasoned Democrat Terry McAuliffe for governor. That amounted to a warning for Democrats that their grip on power could be in peril in next year's midterms. Most voters in Virginia said drawn-out negotiations in Washington over Biden's governing agenda were an important factor in their vote. So blame was flowing to Capitol Hill, as Democrats have spent months arguing over details of the package. "We've got to produce," Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia told reporters at the Capitol. "We've got to get results for people." Democrats are now trying to iron out their differences, particularly with holdout Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. The family leave provision Manchin had resisted earlier is expected to include 4 weeks of paid time off for childbirth, recovery from major illness, or caring for family members, according to three people familiar with the legislation who requested anonymity to discuss it. Biden reluctantly dropped a scaled-back paid leave proposal from last week's White House framework after Manchin balked at the cost. But Democrats who have lobbied for a paid leave program as a Democratic priority for decades continue to push it, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced Wednesday it would be part of the House's massive package. It's a policy that will finally give workers and their families the peace of mind of knowing that when disaster strikes, they can rely on paid leave to avoid total crisis, said Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal in a statement. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Colorado's safety net health centers are on a fast track to bring more people of color and those living in rural areas into good-paying healthcare jobs. Sarah McCrander with the Colorado Community Health Network says a new grant from SyncUp Colorado will allow health centers to develop staff that are connected to their communities and patients.
Because we know that when people receive care from people that look like them or from the community that they live in, the care and the health outcomes improve.
The Grow Our Own initiative will give clinics tools to connect with youths from historically underrepresented communities and help them make important first steps toward health careers they may not have seen as possible. Anyone interested in joining the program, which will initially focus on recruiting medical assistants, can find more information at missiondrivencareers.org. Nearly 9 in 10 new jobs in Colorado require a post-secondary degree, but just 58% of residents have a professional certificate or college degree. Two-thirds of graduates also end up with significant student loan debt. McCrander says by teaming up with colleges and universities, students will be able to earn decent wages as they work toward a range of certificates and degrees.
Say you're a radiology tech and you've done a certification through that you'll be able to apply some of those credits that you earned through that certification program to a future bachelor degree.
Grow Our Own was one of six winning partnerships using modern apprenticeships and hybrid college approaches to increase student access to the state's fastest-growing industries that pay a living wage, including healthcare and construction. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This extension goes till December 3rd.
Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Chair Peter DeFazio spoke as the House voted last night to temporarily reauthorize transportation funding set to expire October 31st. Progressives refused to approve the bill as talks continue on the $1.75 trillion budget reconciliation package. Missouri Republican Sam Graves blamed the delay on partisan politics.
This predicament highlights more than ever the need for us to be working across the aisle and across the building, for that matter.
Things got heated in the House Oversight Committee after Chair Carolyn Maloney threatened to subpoena big oil executives for records of their messaging about climate change.
Big oil has escaped accountability for its central role in bringing our planet to the brink of a climate catastrophe. That ends today.
She also called on the executives to pledge to stop funding the opposition of emission reductions. However, Byron Donalds of Florida and other Republicans accused Democrats of demonizing the industry.
It is absolutely disgusting. Somebody needs to go call Merrick Garland, tell him to get in here and watch the intimidation that came from this very panel today. Because this is not about defending big oil or defending big anything. It's about defending the ability of people in our country to be free, say what they want, think what they want, spend their money how they choose.
Now to Europe, where climate is among the topics during President Joe Biden's first audience with Pope Francis. Biden will participate in his first session of the G20 tomorrow. Bogus election rules, voter intimidation, and false claims about election security are among the most common forms of election disinformation. According to a new report from Common Cause, fed by social media, mainstream media, search engines, as well as emails and robocalls. Yosef Getachew with the group says Facebook and Twitter aren't enforcing their own policies to take action on disinformation.
If there was content showing that the election was rigged, which isn't true, they would have removed it back then, but they're not removing it now.
The report recommends reforms to state and federal laws regarding voting rights, campaign finance, privacy, and media.
And so we think that actually creating more robust sources of news can help alleviate some of those challenges.
Getachew argues the significant decline of local news has driven people to digital sources, which are rife with disinformation.
Congratulations to our colleague on this moment and all that it represents.
Minority Leader Mitch McConnell celebrated Maine Republican Susan Collins' perfect attendance record as she recorded 8,000 consecutive votes. Her streak started in 1997 with a confirmation vote of approval for Madeleine Albright as Secretary of State. Former Wisconsin Senator William Proxemire still holds the record at 10,252 votes. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
AINC programming is brought to you by Wana Brands, enhancing customers' lives through the responsible use of cannabis.